The story of Discord is actually interesting. It's really three things. One is founder market fit. Second, his co-founder Stan was already running groups and servers for voice chat for all his own friends and various people who were playing games. And then the third was, I remember when Discord was being built and sort of metrics were starting to come in, taking it to Josh Ellman at Greylock, who had done, I think, LinkedIn and Facebook and Twitter,
legendary social investor.
And he looked at it and he looked at the metrics and he goes, that's huge. So you got three things suddenly right in front of my eyes where I said, wow, this is going to be big. You got an investor who's seeing the metrics. You got a founder who has founder market fit, and you've got a co-founder who's already tinkering with the product market fit. And this thing is starting to happen.
Welcome, climbers, to another episode of Climb by VSC. I'm your host, Jay Kapoor, general partner of VSC Ventures and co-host of Climb. Today, I'm thrilled to have in our studio, Peter Rellin, joining us here in our San Francisco studio. Peter, you've been a Silicon Valley operator, entrepreneur, investor for over 40 years. And as the founder of the UWeb Incubator, you have been the earliest backer in companies like OpenFaint, CrowdStar, and of course, Discord. You were also one of our earliest supporters at VSC Ventures. So I'm just so thrilled to sit down with you today. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks. Yeah, it's a great long-term association, and it's nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, well, I would love to dive in. Maybe not go directly into your background because we could spend an entire hour on that. Maybe I'll ask it in this way. UWeb started around the same time that Y Combinator got going. You know, Techstars was out there, but you had a very different model. It was this low volume, high signal, high touch model. So talk to me about why that made sense for you and how it differentiated you from some of the other incubator accelerator models out there.
Thanks. Yeah, I think we were, we started 2007, and by that time we had YC 2005-ish, I think they were up and running, Techstars. And so it's a great question because when we started with our first cohort, which was 2007, I guess as an engineer and technologist, my personal inclination is to spend as much time with technical founders in my ventures.
Yeah.
So I think we saw what YC was doing. And I remember at that time, Paul Graham was talking about, we have 10 companies in our first core, we're going to have 40, then we're going to do two classes and we're going to have 100. And I remember him specifically saying, I'll do 10-minute sessions with founders in mentoring and so on. So you'd get 10 minutes with Paul. And my inclination was to spend 2 hours a day with each founder.
Yeah.
So I figured, okay, they're going to do something great. They're gearing up for scale. But if I want to do 2-3 hours a day with each founder, I have to do something different.
Yeah.
So it was really driven by a personal preference, which then became a differentiated model.
Yes.
So I would just sponsor maybe 2 founders a year. And that's what we've done since 2007, over 17 years, maybe 30 or so founders. And it's been beautiful. But obviously, YC and Techstars have been great, but I have no regrets.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I really loved looking at, looking back on your journey, is how early you would be to trends, maybe 3 to 5 years even before they became popular in the zeitgeist. I mean, going back to mobile, gaming, AI, I think you were talking about and investing in back in 2015 and 16. Now it's generative AI is all the rage. And then even more recently, climate, where you have now been investing for 3-4 years. What is it about your process or your team that allows you to kind of be early to these ideas and these trends?
Well, thanks. I mean, I always say luck. Never forget. One of my favorite phrases to founders is, skill is the ability to capitalize on luck. And so never underestimate the importance of just being at the right place at the right time. I felt like in 2007, I happened to start the incubator right when the iPhone was coming out and the App Store would come out in 2008 and when Facebook opened its API.
Yeah.
I mean, those are pretty big events in the history of mobile and social, as you know. I also think there is a my own career. I've been through personally so many inflections now. So I started my career in PC computing. So that was the first revolution. Then I went and worked as a research engineer for one of the co-founders of the internet and TCP/IP. So the internet.
Yep.
After the PC, then I was at Oracle leading Oracle into the web. So the web application server, which at that time when I left, Thomas Kurian took over. He's now running Google Cloud.
Yeah.
But he took over at Oracle. Followed by .com, I became CTO of Webvan.
Yep.
So I'd already been through four inflections personally where I was in it.
Yeah, no.
So when you then step back and become what I call kind of a parallel entrepreneur, incubator runner, you kind of sense it. And you know, talking to founders, and I do read a lot. I spend 2 hours a day reading.
Mm-hmm.
So between the intersection of what you're hearing from founders that I'm always trying to meet, and what I'm reading, there is a Venn diagram of things that sort of bubble up, right?
Yeah.
In 2007, 2008, OpenFaint, CrowdStar, one focused on the App Store, one focused on Facebook gaming. I mean, I couldn't have asked for a better start.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, yeah. Well, you mentioned this idea about parallel entrepreneur and your incubator model working really side by side. Practically, what does that mean in terms of how you're working with these founders? What's the sort of support and guidance that you're able to give them?
So what I love is founders who may not even have a product idea yet. So, you know, when you went up and applied to YC, you needed a small team at least and a prototype. So you kind of have your product. But what I'm looking for is founder market fit.
Mm.
So if a founder like a Jason Citron, who knows gaming really well, comes along, or we had another founder who was in EdTech who came along, we just want to kind of tap into this founder market fit.
Yep.
And co-build the product market fit.
Yeah.
That's what's different about UWeb. You can actually do that.
Yeah.
So I like to actually sit with a founder and say, oh, you seem to know a lot about gaming, and or you seem to know a lot about climate tech, or you know a lot about education or AI. Let's talk about what's going on in that space. And then sometimes it's as detailed as, hey, I will stay up all night and I'll help you debug this memory leak.
Wow.
Because you've got this app with I remember CrowdStar had 8 million daily actives.
Wow.
And they were just, the servers were struggling, and you know how it is.
Yeah.
And I'm there just to feed them with pizzas and Cokes. So they get, not that I'm doing the memory leak debugging.
Yeah.
But enough technical knowledge that they feel that this guy is not just here like as a restaurant service, but he understands the pain of debugging this bug.
Yeah.
And that's why he's here.
Yeah.
So I think you just want to be very involved in their journey.
I think it's so interesting to hear you say that. You know, my first kind of investing job was at Techstars. And I remember the conversations at like 9, 10 p.m., right? Because we had the space and everybody was working there, and there's, you know, 10, 12 different companies. And it was really those like 9, 10 o'clock conversations where the employees have gone home. The founders are still there. They just finished their takeout. And that's when they needed your guidance, shoulder to cry on.
Support?
You know,
just support. They had a bad
emotional support.
Yeah, exactly.
And you just realize how early just somebody sitting there with you going, wow, that's really cool. Or keep going. You know, I know you had a bad sales call today. Maybe tomorrow will be different. How meaningful that is. And I find that those folks, they remember you.
Yeah, they do. I remember once I was helping a founder whose company got acquired by Facebook.
Yeah.
And he literally would sleep at the incubator. We had a, you know, pull out futon.
Yeah, of course.
From 4 a.m. to about 1 p.m.
Yeah.
So we'd leave. I'd leave around 3 a.m. I would come back by 10 or 11 because there were other founders to hang out with and talk to. And this guy's sleeping there still. So I'd see him before he went to bed, and I wake him up in the morning, or afternoon. So as far as he was concerned, the last person he saw was me, and the first person he saw after he woke up was me. That's pretty meaningful to a founder, right?
Sure, yeah, that's very memorable. So talking about where you're investing now pretty actively on the climate side, you know, one of the things that I really noticed as our fund has gotten active in this space is the profile of the founder and how it's changed from that classic, you know, coder and a hoodie with a laptop to experienced executive, subject matter expert, you know, first time founder, but maybe one that comes to it with 20 years of industry backing. How does that change how you evaluate that company, that founder market fit on the journey to product market fit? And what are the markers that you have to look for to maybe help them avoid some pitfalls?
Yeah, so I think, you know, what I've learned, I've worked with about now 30 startups and very deeply, meaningfully. And by the way, you know, we've had our failures. In an incubator, you take risk also that is very early stage and you pivot or you just shut down. One thing I've seen in common with founders is if they have incredible passion, you see that in almost all would-be or aspiring founders, because otherwise they wouldn't be taking that risk and, you know, giving up other perks they might get in the tech industry. But it's that incredible clarity that you're seeking about what they will do and what they won't do. That's really important. And if you can be an experienced founder and not have that clarity, you could be 20 years in, coming out of a large corporation, and we've sponsored a few of those, and have passion but not have that clarity because you just never participated in a large company with that kind of a hardcore, you know, on-off kind
focus.
Of focus. Yeah, you can get by with hazy decision-making. So, for example, you see that when I first met Jason, he's passionate and he's gaming focused, so yeah. Clearly founder market fit. But it was only very important. He was extremely vocal about, I would never do that to myself as a gamer. Mm-hmm. And so to this day, in Discord, for example, no advertising. He had told me way back, I hate it when an ad pops up when I'm gaming. I don't want that ad in front of my face.
Yep.
Right? He's so focused on the game as a gamer that he knows what other gamers want and is very clear.
Yeah.
I'm never going to do that.
Yeah.
So you want that crystal clarity, if you can find it, whether they're older founders, younger founders. You want technical skills and you want this passion, of course.
Yeah.
Right? But those are, I would say, table stakes. This clarity is what sets them apart.
It's so interesting to hear you talk about opinionated founders because, you know, you take pitches all the time. Obviously, you guys do 100 a month, probably, you know, between our team. I find that sometimes founders, especially first-time founders, they almost like want to mirror what the VC wants to hear.
And yeah, there's value in that because you get funding.
But to build a really big business, what I'm hearing from you is you kind of need to be opinionated. You need to lead with what you know you like.
You know, not even our class, but if you remember Drew Houston's story on Dropbox,
yeah,
he apparently went to 100 VCs and they said, oh, but this is SharePoint, Google Drive. You know, what's another storage company? And there are all these other storage startups. And his point to them was, yeah, but have you used their products? They are crappy. And he stuck to that.
Yeah.
He never said, yeah, you're right. You know, maybe I should become an enterprise portal or maybe I should do this. Or maybe. He just stuck to, that's a bad product. I have a better product. And it apparently took 100 VCs to get this pitch right. So it's a risk. You take a risk on that. But I personally find I'd rather back that founder through the sort of hard times of fundraising. It's also easier because you're not constantly trying to please other people. You're following your clear passion, right?
On the flip side, as an investor, can you help a founder find focus? And what are some ways that you can help them do that?
Yeah, I have found that there are some people who are able to transform into that. And the less experience they have, the better, actually.
Okay.
The more experience they have, the more they trust their judgment. So if I come to somebody and say, you know, that pitch, it doesn't have that clarity of what exactly you're going to do and what your vision is and what you're not going to do. Because I think the biggest thing that people don't realize is a startup and a founder, how they have to say no to certain things. It's not about just saying, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. It's about saying, I'm not going to do this and I'm not. I think Steve Jobs has articulated this. It's better to do a few things extremely well than doing a lot of things, right?
Yeah.
So when you tell a founder, I don't think you should do that. I think you should stick to this. And they don't kind of respond to that. They don't like feel that that's the right answer. You kind of know it's hard for them to transform.
Yeah.
Those who actually say, that's interesting. I was thinking of doing that. But now that you pointed out, yeah, that's a stupid idea. Why am I doing this? There is the crown. There is the gold.
Yeah, yeah. I'll tell you on a personal level, that was one of the things that convinced me to come build VSC Ventures with Vijay. So at my last fund, we were trying to be all things to all people. We had about 70 portfolio companies over the life of, you know, our investment life. And some were helping with sales, some were helping with their pitch deck, some were helping with recruiting. And when you're trying to do 8 different things, I don't care how much AUM you have, how much staff you have, you're never going to be good at all of those things. That's hard if you're Andreessen or whoever, right? The one beautiful thing about, I think, what I get to do every day and working with our VSE team, we know what we're good at. It's PR, it's storytelling, it's marketing, it's that subset. And there's almost a clarity of how you can express that to founders. And you can say, if you need this, you know where to come.
And you've done that recently for one of our climate tech.
Yeah.
You
know, in Mexico. Yeah, it was right.
So, and we see it. I see the storytelling really starting to come out. I mean, seeing the stories from Alex on LinkedIn with Concrete AI. So I actually think that this is what differentiated UWeb. There were so many companies that would say, well, I could go to YC and so on. I would actually encourage them. I said, you know what? You should go to YC. All right. You are a founder with an MBA and you have another founder, co-founder, who seems to understand the insurance market. Neither of you are people I can really host here because neither of you are techie developers.
Yeah.
But there are incubators like Techstars and YC and many others that came along.
Yeah.
Where you do great. And I would personally call up somebody like Jeff Ralston and say, he was the president of YC in the old days. Hey, Jeff, would you like to host the Esteem? It looks great to me, but I can't host them because what I do is this very focused thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think it's worked for us as well, to your point.
Absolutely. I mean, there's power in that clarity. Speaking about technical founders, especially as we talk about the folks that are building in hard legacy industry problems, what are some things you think technical founders need to do sooner in their journey? What's a piece of advice you give them that doesn't get taken enough?
So I think the single biggest piece of advice for any technical founder is talk to your target customer ASAP. Because there's something magical about getting involved in technology building that lets you drift into a world of vision, imagination, and just engineering.
Yeah.
And it's almost, you know, like just say it's addictive. You can wake up every day and just hack and program. And as soon as you take your eye off have I spoken to a customer today? Not whether I've sold.
Yeah.
Have I just talked to somebody about what I'm building?
Yeah.
Even if it's very early, I find that those who have that discipline and say, oh, yeah, I'm going to take at least, and they have founder market fit, so obviously they should be able to talk, right? I mean, if you are a gamer, you go to other gamers. If you are working in the insurance industry or climate tech, there are people who you can talk to. That, I think, is what differentiates, again, the probability of success goes up. If a lot of people aren't, it's not that they don't want to.
Okay.
It's that they are embarrassed to. So Reid Hoffman has said it best. If you ship your first product and you're not embarrassed about it, you're too late. That's what Reid is saying, right?
Yeah.
And so I find that they're always like, you know, actually, let me talk in about 3 weeks when I have this feature or that. Then I'll feel good. And I respect that because as an engineer, I also don't want to show something crappy.
Yeah.
But I think that you have to get over it.
Yeah.
You have to sort of, because good other people understand when you're early, if you provide the context.
Yeah, I think you're right. There's a trap that I think founders fall into where, you know, you're working with maybe one customer, especially in climate tech, we see.
Or B2B.
These design partners, right? And as you start working with that one design partner, they keep requesting feature 14, feature 15, feature 16. And at some point you have to say, let me go talk to 10 more customers and let's see what they actually need. Because it gets very easy to just say yes.
Absolutely.
And coming back to your point, saying no, having focus ultimately is what's going to allow you to scale.
And it's especially true when you look at founders in the physical space.
Okay.
Like, you know, so we've obviously done a lot in gaming, software, AI, now climate tech. In climate tech, I'm now doing a lot more of green tech. And green tech, look at concrete AI software.
Yeah.
But software applied to concrete factories. Well, we're also sort of funding people. We're doing real industrial equipment for climate tech.
Yeah.
And that also is an interesting twist. Because when you are a software founder, you can take the approach of, you know, the Facebook approach, you know, ship things, break things, fix things fast.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So we have one IoT startup in BevTech, and what we learned was that just doesn't work. It's just too costly. There's a lot more planning and design. So there's another sort of, if you had to advise founders on what to do in hardware startups, there was an example of a company trying to build a juicer called Juicero.
No, I
raised $100 million, right?
I remember that.
And they built this beautiful juicer, razor cartridge model. I mean, amazing model, very experienced founder. But you put the juice, this juice pack into the juicer, and comes the juice. It turned out that you can just take the juice
pack and just squeeze it.
Pretty in the pack, yeah.
You just squeeze it, and out comes the juice. So there goes the razor cartridge model.
Yeah.
We had a company in BevTech called the Chime, which is brewchime.com, which is a chai tea latte maker. Think of it as an espresso or Keurig for chai.
Yeah.
Fresh brewed chai as opposed to syrup or powder. And at the time Juicero went bust, this company, its founders, raised about $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually wrote a blog on Medium, how to avoid spending $100 million on building your hardware product.
Yeah.
And how to do it for $1 million. And what you have to really do is know that you don't get that chance to ship fast and break things and then fix them. Like in this case, the break was basically existential.
Yeah.
Right, for Juicer.
Yeah.
For Juicero.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, so I think that's another twist we found is founders who are able to not just talk to customers, but predict the customer reaction in a hardware product. Because by the time you ship it, and you get the response,
you've already spent the money.
You spent the money. And hardware, that's a very expensive cycle.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, it's important to hear that because I think in climate, so much of it interfaces with the real world. Whether you're using off-the-shelf parts or you're building something proprietary, there is that capital. What I feel like hasn't caught up yet is the capital stack for founders like that, right? Because they're going and raising equity capital. They're turning around. They're pumping it into first-of-a-kind production or hardware. And it dilutes the founder in a way that they're not able to maybe build in this sort of simple software stack that a software company.
Exactly. That's a lesson I think our founders in the climate cohort are learning.
Okay.
That, you know, they see the billionaire, you know, founders in the software era, whether it's Bezos or Larry Ellison, my ex-boss, or Letta Zuckerberg, and you can see they're holding on to 20-30% of their companies.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
You take a hardware company, and you can see this with, let's say, Juniper or some of the, you know, networking infrastructure companies. You look at the founder CEO, they have 5% when the company is going public, right?
Yep.
And there's a reason. You're building hardware. The capital required is far more, and the cycle time is far greater. And if you have an issue, and the capital required to build the next generation is far greater. So, I think that slowly it's percolating that this is not the same thing as in climate tech in particular.
Yeah.
Because it has extremely long payback periods.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So the dilution is going to be higher.
Yeah.
But you're also going for like big moonshots. So presumably you'll have a smaller piece of a much, much, much larger pie.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at NVIDIA today, I mean, it's hard to understand.
Every day.
if you ask me what was the one investment that you regret not making, I'd say it's NVIDIA last year, right? Not even a startup. I think the whole capital stack for climate tech, hardware startups, even AI startups, why is Sam Altman talking about $7 trillion? I mean, we're talking trillions will have to be spent in these areas of next generation AI, hardware, climate tech. And that's a whole different mentality founders have to
used
to.
Are there other idiosyncrasies about climate that you've noticed with this accelerator that you wish founders knew a little bit earlier or maybe should act on a little bit earlier?
Yeah, I think what I'm starting to understand, and you know, for me, climate is 3-4 years. I started researching it. Then I said, okay, we'll build a cohort focused on it, is that nobody truly understands the problem.
Okay.
In the sense that we all have these meetings around the world, COP 25, 26, 27, and we all have goals, 1.5 degrees. I think we've blown past that. I think that's happened. Now it's 2 degrees Celsius. The fundamental problem with the climate problem is all the models, right? And this is where I think AI could be extremely helpful. All the models today have never been able to accurately predict the tipping points.
Yeah.
And apparently the tipping points are moving faster than the models have predicted.
Yep.
Right? So nobody is, and you don't want to address a climate change problem post a tipping point. You want to head it off, right?
Yeah.
So think about the juicer problem, already a huge problem if you've shipped a juicer and now you discover the problem. Well, when you think of climate tech, if you've hit a tipping point and then you're addressing, it's a trillion times worse, right?
Yeah.
So how can AI which is an area I've been involved in now in the previous cohort for two or three companies of ours. How can we do a better job at predicting these tipping points? Because none of the climate models are able to do a good job today.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then we might have a very good shot at saying, hey, in 7 years, if we don't do X or Y, then this will happen, mm-hmm. right? Which is what you're sort of seeing in the AI. Why is NVIDIA having blowout quarters? Because they have such a great visibility into their pipeline.
Use case.
Also hardware.
Yeah.
But they know that, you know, in climate, it's very murky, you know, pardon the pun. I mean, it's just not clear. So we need better visibility.
Yeah.
And I think AI can help a lot.
Is it a shortcoming of AI? Just that, you know, models are built on past predictors, right? Our friends at Concrete AI using 7 million data sets of past performance to predict future performance. I think in an industry like that, that makes a lot of sense. When you start to look at folks that are doing it for farming or they're doing it for shipping and logistics, these things are changing at a rate that no model has seen before. And if you've never seen it before, how can you project out?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting point. So let's divide it into two areas, okay? Yeah. One area is where the numbers are clear.
Yeah.
So the numbers are clear the following ways. We have about 500 million tons of carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases up in the air. Now, it's about 300 billion tons more than it should be,
yeah,
compared to the pre-industrial era. So that number is clear. We're adding about 35 to 40 billion tons a year as a human society, right? And that number is not significantly slowing down. Electrification is happening. We know what to do with battery tech. You know what to do with EVs. We know what to do with the grid. And slowly it's happening. And you can do all the math and say, here's how much we can bring down our emissions, okay? That much is extremely clear. And you can see the startups getting, and the big companies getting funded on that, whether it's Tesla, whether it's, Redwood, you know, materials for recycling batteries and so on. Now the part is, okay, even if we electrify everything and decarbonize everything, what's going to happen? Well, if you just project 10 years out and say 35 to 40 billion tons goes to 35 to 30 to 20, you still in 10 years are going to end up with 700 billion tons.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Which is three times more than is healthy. That's the part that is hard to understand. What happens when there's 700 billion tons of carbon dioxide up there?
Yeah.
Because that's my projection, even if we electrify everything and turn into EVs and all as fast as we can.
Right? Yeah.
So we are betting in the incubator on what we call CDR, carbon dioxide removal.
Yep.
Which is, at the end of the day, we have to suck out carbon dioxide. Because I don't see the 700 billion tons being healthy, right?
Oh, no.
And we have to, but we can't do it by sucking it out of the chimneys of fossil fuel plants.
Yeah.
All we're doing is, just recycling. We have to suck it out. We have to sequester it, or we have to put it into concrete and steel as decarbonizing utilization methods.
Yeah.
That part of what happens when you're doing 700 billion tons in the atmosphere is what nobody can understand.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
So all you can do is say, let's build things that'll suck it out, or let's build things that doesn't put more in.
Yeah.
That's what's known. What's unknown is, how fast are you going? Is it fast enough? Is it enough?
Yeah.
Nobody knows that.
Yeah.
And there are no models for that.
No, and the other thing that I think is unclear, you know, we invest the seed stage, or even a stage earlier than us, when you're coming with these companies, is whether the downstream capital is going to be there. And I think one of the interesting things in 2021 and 2022 is we saw so many of these generalist funds, multi-billion dollar funds, the three-letter, four-letter names that we all know, say we are investing in climate. You had a bunch of seed and series A investor-backed climate companies, and here we sit in early 2024. Where's the downstream capital?
I think that's a really... So we are doing the same thing we did with Chime and Juicero.
Okay.
What I am focusing on is we should need 10 times less capital than what everybody else is planning for their Series A,
really?
Series B.
Okay.
Why? Because you can focus, like one of our first incubees that'll be spinning out, DAC Lab, which we'll talk about later this year. What we're focused on is making sure that the IP and the technology at the lab and pilot scale continues to improve to such dramatic levels that when we do need that growth capital, that's the time when you ask for big money. Until then, you are extremely engineering and R&D focused at that smaller scale, because then I think you need $5 million, $7 million as opposed to the $50 or $100 million. So it's you know, look, Chime, we have more customers with Chime than Juicero has ever had with $5 million raised total to date over 8 years.
Yeah.
And I think with climate tech, there are some lessons there, which is do your R&D thoughtfully, do your engineering design and design for manufacturing as well. And when you want to hit scale, you should be ready for that big capital, but not spend a lot of money getting there.
Yeah, it's tough sometimes for me where I see really meaningful projects that look more like infrastructure projects than they like venture projects.
Yeah.
And we're a $21 million fund, right? And I don't have the money to keep backing you round three, round four, round five. And ultimately, I think that sometimes becomes a big reason why we pass on things that good technologists, strong founder market fit, but looks more like a project finance.
Exactly. Project finance is, so look at Webvan. We raised $800 million.
Yeah.
In reality, the company could have done with $200 million
yeah.
for its core and Bay Area operations, what I would call the R&D center prototype.
Yeah.
The other $600 million for being all over the U.S. in 25 cities, which is where we did raise equity financing, should have really come from project financing.
Yeah.
Right? With the IRRs and payback. So apply that same principle. I would say climate tech startups that are doing their R&D work with equity financing and then being patient and thoughtful to get project financing for their infrastructure expansion.
Yeah.
That's the real secret. You combine the two. I've been there, right?
Webvan.
I mean, you spend that money real fast, and it's all equity.
Yeah.
So we have to develop new models, and I think you guys could be educating the project financiers as to why they need to step in, rather than, you know, like you said, $21 million fund. Same here for me, incubator, right?
Yeah.
We typically don't run any class for more than $10 million. So this cohort is not going to spend more than $10 million. And if you can imagine, they're working on six, seven ideas and companies in climate tech.
Yeah, right? Yeah. When you are looking at founders that are building in this space, especially how early they are, especially how technical they are, how do you assess their ability to grow as leaders and CEOs? Like, I think of Jason and Discord as an example, right? Technical founder, sold that first business, you know, built it up, sold it, came back around. When you met him at 22, did you know, wow, this guy's going to build a massive business and he's going to be a leader? Or is that something that you had to, you know, help develop along the way?
I think at 22, we knew nothing. We just knew he was a smart guy who dropped out of one kind of class and went to Full Sail and like really passionate, really clear. After OpenFaint, which had 40,000 developers as a developer kit for games on iPhone and then 100 million users, you know, behind those games, it was clear that this is a great entrepreneur.
Yeah.
Now, the story of Discord is actually interesting. It's really three things. One is founder market fit. Here, this is another product. He's come back. He knows gaming, right? Okay. Second, his co-founder, Stan, was already running groups and servers for voice chat for all his own friends and various people who were playing games.
Yep.
Right? So you got another kind of founder market fit. He was then, and Jason were discussing how crappy the voice chat was on these servers using older products like TeamSpeak or whatever, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you got this beginning of product market fit, but there's talking about, look, I could just build a much better product, which is do great. And then the third was, I remember when Discord was being built and sort of metrics were starting to come in, taking it to Josh Ellman at Greylock, who had done, I think, LinkedIn and Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah, legendary social investor. Yeah.
And he looked at it and he looked at the metrics and he goes, that's huge. So you got three things suddenly right in front of my eyes where I said, wow. This is going to be big.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You got an investor who's seeing the metrics. You've got a founder who has good founder market fit. And you've got a co-founder who's already tinkering with the product market fit.
Yeah.
And this thing is starting to happen, right?
Yeah.
So I by the way, one more thing. It always helps to have a technical inflection point. In this case, it was WebRTC. WebRTC was in the browser, a codec where you could have voice and video decoding.
Yep.
So now you didn't need to download an app to do, you know, like
Skype. Yeah, I remember in the old days, you have to download Skype.
You just click on a button on Twitter where it would say, join Discord, click browser, and you're in the voice chat.
Yep.
So you really, you know, when you look at a founder, you look at everything around them as well, right? So in climate tech, I'm looking now at like, okay, who are their connections or who are other people we can bring in who can be the connectors?
Yep.
And what does the core science here? So in our case, for DAC Lab, we have a person who came out of bioengineering and chemistry and economics and said, okay, this person understands finance a little bit. They understand core science, you know.
Yeah.
Let's kind of help them. And it's been 2.5 years of incubation. So now we're going from 1 year of incubation at UWeb to 2 to 3 years before we spin out. Yeah. Because it's a science thing. It's yeah. not software.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you think about, in climate tech specifically, the IRA? Is it a tailwind? Is it something you know, say is relevant, but maybe not as relevant for early stage companies? I always hear founders pitch us using the IRA as one reason their company will be successful, and color me a skeptic. So I'm curious how you think about the IRA in the context of startups.
Yeah, so I might be on both sides of this. Okay. Like, if you go to uwebinc.com, right there it'll say accelerating public-private partnerships.
Okay.
With the idea, which is exactly what you've said, which is we don't want to put a lot of capital to work because of the principle I articulated yeah. earlier, which is we must do R&D and science and engineering well. We want the government in the IRA to step in with particularly R&D credits. And not even because, you know, there are R&D credits that you get or just funds. Grants from, you know, DOE, ARPA, yeah. the energy part of DOE, ARPA-E it's called. And then we also want funding for the operating side when you actually are doing things that you get the tax credits, basically, like or operational credits. Like if you're doing carbon dioxide removal, for every ton of carbon dioxide removed and actually put away, you can get $185 per ton. Mm-hmm. That doesn't come till later. But you got to be operational, like you got to have your project financed.
Yeah.
So at the moment, I would say where the IRA needs to really, you know, power through is get those R&D grants out, you know, because that is both great national interest and two, it's like a must have. If you can't get the R&D right, the thing you will scale.
Yeah.
With these operational credits, it's just not going to be right.
Yeah.
So we are seeing them apply these operational credits to projects where I'm a little concerned that the R&D hasn't been done right yet.
Yeah.
Right. So I think that R&D is very important right now. It's a 10-year window for the IRA. So I would say over the next 2 years, the R&D has got to be done right. Then 8 years of getting those operational credits to scale up.
Yeah. And I think we're seeing more interest from the government as a customer.
Yes.
But the process by which you become a customer of the government is, you know, CBER grant one, CBER grant two. Finally, maybe they give you a, you know, RFP and you're bidding against legacy companies. Nobody has looked at that process.
Nobody.
And to me, I think revisiting that and saying, we know there is interest on the government side. We know that there's interest on the startup side, but we've created these legacy hurdles for these people to talk to each other.
Yeah, I think you're right on. Let me tell you a concrete story,
yeah.
pun intended.
Yes.
We have an investment in a company called Gradient, right? Gradient Technologies is building heat pumps. The founder is brilliant, Vincent. He was at Cal, did his PhD, and 13 failed R&D applications.
Wow.
All right.
But he kept at it.
He kept at it. But he said, I just knew I had to keep applying. Finally, let me tell you where he's at. He's raised $14 million in non-dilutive funding to date.
Wow.
After
that's a Series A round.
Exactly, right? And now he's on to a Series B.
Yeah.
And he recently got a $17 million grant under the Defense Production Act to take over a factory in Michigan
yeah.
and build out heat pump production lines there. $17 million granted. One of 10 companies that got these DPA things in climate tech. It's a real case study. How do you avoid the 13 failures? Because this guy would be so far ahead. And he hadn't had to wait 5 years and 13. So we need to get to maybe, like, our people have done maybe 2 or 3 applications.
Okay.
Didn't succeed.
Yeah.
We always tell them, you know, there's 11 more to go before you get your funding. But I just fundamentally believe that, look, 2 or 3, after that, you've got to start giving these founders who keep applying some credit for yeah. their assistance. You yeah. can't do this 13. I mean, that was very lucky
yes.
that Vincent got to that level, you know. But R&D now is accelerating, and you can't. So there needs to be, maybe it's you guys or some partner that comes into the ecosystem and just like tightens up that process, helps with the SBI,
yes.
helps with the, you know, grants.
Believe me, we've thought about it. On a litany list of 8 things that I wish I could snap my fingers and do, and maybe that'll be a project for fun too for us. Peter, as we close, I would love to chat with you about the you know, basically what we ask a lot of our guests on the show. There is a lot of doom and gloom in climate today. There's media stories about how we're not moving fast enough. There is concerns about what happens after the election and if Trump comes back and, you know, repeals and does all this stuff. In the face of all of that, what keeps you optimistic about technology and the role that it's going to play in the climate transition?
I mean, I have to say, I have my days. I have my up days and my down
days.
When I read 2 hours a day still, and there are days I go to bed or I wake up and I'm like, this is looking awful. But at the end of the day, my trend is upward on optimism. And there's a very simple reason why. It's sort of like you've got 100 fighter jets in the air. You can't see. It's very foggy. As I mentioned, we don't have good models, right? But we have a lot of experienced, you know, fighter jet pilots all on board. There is not, I mean, I find founders today choosing climate tech over AI and software.
Really?
Absolutely.
With all the money?
With all the money that's there, and especially AI, like, no, I want to solve an existential problem. I don't want to just solve the next, I don't want to build the next Meta or the next Twitter or the next, I want to solve this problem. If they're millennials, they have young children, they're like, what kind of kid, or, you know, what kind of places for our kids, right?
Yeah.
And if they're Gen Z, they don't even believe that this political solution will work. They just fundamentally, you know, believe that, look, the only way this will work, if Greta Thunberg couldn't get enough people riled up, and if COP28, we come out and it's being hosted in, you know, the Middle East, Dubai, whatever.
Yeah.
They're so skeptical. I mean, you think you're skeptical?
Wait till you talk about the time with Gen Z.
Yeah, with the 22-year-old founders I meet. So for them, it's existential. It's like, I can't imagine life after I'm 30. Unless I help solve this problem. So, I've always believed in passion and clarity and founders, right?
Yeah.
To me, I have never seen an era of better founder market fit for climate tech than now with Gen Z and millennials. It is literally existential founder market fit. Why? You are the person facing this issue. I came back from India. It was 500 ppm on the 2.5 millimeter AQI, right? It feels ashy in your tongue.
Oh, yeah. Every time I go to Delhi now, I'm coughing on a daily basis. You get used to what the air quality is like where you live, and then you go, you know, drive around the city.
Exactly.
Feel it.
Yes. And even here, yeah. LA. Oh, more rain in one day than all of February in 100. So I think the founder market fit in these two age groups is extremely strong because they feel the effects. They have their kids, or they are basically young people. And they are very committed. So that's really important for me. When I read a depressing story about us not meeting our goals, I look around, I go into the office, and I talk to these people, and I feel better.
Peter, that is so encouraging. Your energy and your passion for these founders has me inspired. So
thank you
so much for spending this time with me today. This was great.
Thank you, and thank you for having me, and what a great topic.
Yeah.
Thanks again.
Well, that's it for this week's episode of Climb by VSC. Thank you so much for watching and listening. My thanks to my guest, Peter Rellin, founder of UWeb and legendary Silicon Valley investor, for joining me and sharing some amazing stories here today. Hey, did you know that you can watch as well as listen to every episode of Climb? Head on over to YouTube. We post videos every Wednesday, and we post clips every single day. You can stream those for hours, especially if you need more inspiration and you're getting tired of reading depressing news stories. Lastly, if you enjoyed this episode, we'd love for you to leave us a 5-star review. And if you love this episode, recommend a guest to us. We'd love to have them on the show. Well, that's all for now. Thank you so much for watching Climb by VSC. We'll see you next week.